Minutes after midnight on March 24th, 1989, a pristine natural wilderness would change forever. Just 3 hours into a planned 2,000 nautical mile journey to transport 53 million gallons of crude oil from Valdez, Alaska to Long Beach, California, a gigantic supertanker tore into an underwater reef. At 12:04 a.m., the Exxon Valdez radioed the U.S. Coast Guard. "We've fetched up, hard aground," it said, "and we're evidently leaking some oil." Nearly 11 million gallons of crude oil would spew into Alaska's Prince William Sound. At the time, it was the largest oil spill in U.S. history, and it remains one of the nation's biggest ecological disasters. With cleanup efforts hampered by the austere location, the oil slick would eventually cover 1,300 miles of coastline. The contamination killed an estimated 250,000 seabirds, 3,000 otters, 300 seals, 250 bald eagles, and 22 killer whales. The salmon and herring fisheries in Prince William Sound collapsed shortly after the disaster. Some reports put the spill's economic toll as high as $2.8 billion. The crash of the Exxon Valdez woke the nation's conscience to the profound environmental and economic damage that results from a large oil spill. It led to changes in ship designs and extensive ecological impact studies. It also spurred research into better response methods should an oil spill occur.
One aspect of oil spill response that requires particular attention is the effect of ice and frigid temperatures. Icy conditions can change oil properties and make the substance more difficult to locate or extract. Techniques and technologies that work in warmer environments may need to be adapted to colder regions. While ice didn't have a profound impact on the Exxon Valdez cleanup, the event illuminated the importance of protecting delicate Arctic ecosystems in the event of a spill. That takes on even more urgency as changing climates enable increased Arctic oil exploration and open more shipping lanes, potentially leading to higher activity in the region. Enhancing the nation's preparedness should such a disaster occur again, Arctic's Cold Regions Research and Engineering Laboratory, or CREL, is working closely with partners to study the most effective methods for responding to an oil spill in icy conditions.
I'm Chris Kiefer, and with Megan Saxton, this is The Power of Arctic. Our guest today is Kate Truback, a research general engineer at Arctic CREL. We will talk with Kate about Arctic's oil on ice research and how it bolsters the nation's readiness for responding to and mitigating a potential ecological disaster. Hey, Kate, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess we probably ought to start this discussion at the high level and kind of why this research is so necessary. Can you just talk about how challenging is oil spill cleanup, and do icy conditions make it even more difficult?
So cleaning up oil spills is an incredibly large scale and difficult operation for so many different reasons. There's so many factors that go into a response effort, like location of the spill, how big the spill is, weather conditions, oil type, and that's just a few of them. You have to mobilize huge teams of people and equipment, which, depending on where you are, can be a really difficult task to do. Many of the groups that are response organizations have training for incidents like this, but they're for temperate regions, so very few are actually prepared for cold or ice environments, which means their crew and their equipment may not be able to function in kind of these environments.
Yeah, sure. And so when you're talking about ice, I mean, how does ice change things?
So one of the main problems presented by ice in an oil spill location is obstruction. Large ice flows or sheets of ice can limit the methods you use for recovery or detecting of oil. Many of the oil skimmers that are used for these kinds of things rely on pumping oil from the water's surface back to a tank or a ship or something of that nature. If there's ice in that area, These chunks of ice can build up dams, which blocks the oil from getting to these skimmers. There's also the potential for oil to be trapped underneath the ice itself or even frozen into it. And that makes both identifying the spill very difficult, but you also can't, you know, because you can't see it. But then trying to get some the oil out of that environment can be even more difficult.
And does the cold or the icy conditions change the properties of the oil itself? And does that make things more challenging as well?
Absolutely. So there's so many different types of oil when it comes to crude oils. You have lighter oils, heavy oils, diesel. All of these different things have different properties that are all affected by temperature, sunlight, ice. All of these properties, both physically and chemically, change when it's spilled, depending on where it's spilled. So there's so many different factors that go into this.
And I think maybe when we talked the other day, if I remember right, another factor is even seeing the oil sometimes, locating, finding the oil can be more difficult than the ice. Maybe it blends in more easily.
Yeah, you might not even be able to visually see it because it's trapped underneath the ice of who knows how thick. It can be feet below the ice, which hinders what type of sensor you would use to detect it, much less how you're going to get it out. Do you have to remove the ice first? Do you try and go underneath it? It's a big obstacle you have to overcome.
Sure.
On the surface, this sounds like a very niche research topic. So why is it important to study oil spill response in icy conditions?
It's a very niche topic, which is why it's so crucial that we research it. There's so little known about how oil behaves in and around ice, mostly because there's so many variables. Each type of oil interacts with ice differently due to changes in chemical and physical properties. Some oils are more viscous than others. Some might be more affected by the colder temperatures. Even the structure of the ice is a factor. Sea ice is different than freshwater ice. As saltwater freezes, it pushes salt particles down through the water column, and that creates what's called brine channels. These are like little tubes that vertically run through the ice, and since oil is less dense than water, oil can percolate up through these channels into the ice and even can follow them all the way to the surface. It's because of these conditions that we need to study this. What works in the Gulf of Mexico might not work in Alaska, and in order to prepare for incidents like this, we need to investigate as many scenarios as possible. So these first responders that are going out to these incidents are armed with the most effective solutions possible.
Is some of the reasoning, too, because time is so much of the essence in these responses? I guess every hour, every minute, whatnot, is that much more oil that's spilling into the environment. And I guess because they're so rare and you've got to prepare rapidly, that makes preparation that much more important?
Absolutely. Response time is a huge factor in these kinds of things. Oil weathers in the environment. It evaporates. It changes just by being outside of a barrel. So some oils may weather faster than others and get really thick and you can't even pump them. You can't pull them out of the environment. Some of them even start to sink and then you're kind of out of luck for recovery altogether. How fast it takes you to get to these things is super dependent on what type of recovery you're going to use. If it takes you a week to get out there, you may have to use a different solution than if you get there the next day.
And is some of the reason, I guess, in studying it too, we talked at the top of the show about the Exxon Valdez and the impact it had. And I understand from talking to you that it wasn't necessarily an oil on ice issue that complicated that response. But I guess what that did is it kind of showed the impact that an oil spill can have in any environment, but especially kind of in a pristine kind of natural Arctic ecosystem.
Yeah, that's one of the big driving factors of this research, that particular incident, because it was in such a sensitive environment. So that's one that's identified as, we don't want this to happen again. We want to be better than that. So given what lessons learned from that particular incident, what can we take, what can we improve upon so that those sensitive environments aren't as devastated as they were in that particular spill? How can we improve those situations so that doesn't happen again?
Sure.
What is Arctic's role in this research?
So we're involved in many different levels, from facility support to our krill expertise in the cold and the ice, and even in a little bit in the technology development. There are so many pieces to this puzzle that we try to help out with whatever we can.
And who are some of the partners that you work with in this?
We work with most of the organizations that are involved in this topic. So the Coast Guard is a really big one from both a research and a response perspective. You have the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement that pushes out a lot of the regulations on the oil industry and things like that. The EPA, NOAA, all of these other federal organizations that are involved in all of these pieces of things all have research needs and goals that we kind of help them with. Not to mention, we have industry partners, other research laboratories, universities, and basically anybody that wants to try and improve this technology, methodology, all of these things. Most of the problems we are investigating are so complex that it takes the expertise of several groups to find these solutions. Having these diverse and multidisciplinary teams allows for all of the experts to join forces and give us the best chance at solving these toughest challenges.
So this is very much a collaborative effort.
Absolutely.
Building on that collaboration, and I guess we talked about this being a niche topic, but my understanding is CREL even kind of has a little bit of a niche role in this in terms of you all have carved out a space as the go-to place to do the field studies, correct? Because of the expertise that y'all have shown in kind of creating these artificial conditions. I know you told me before that you can't really go test an oil spill in the actual environment, and you all have become the location where a lot of this research is done. Is that correct? And can you talk more about that?
That is definitely true. We are incredibly fortunate to be surrounded by some of the most unique and specialized facilities at CREL. This place has been in existence in polar research for much, much longer than I have been around, much less most of the people around here. We have so many different tools at our disposal that we're allowed for this specialized kind of research to be conducted. Like you mentioned, you're not going to just be able to run out and do oil spill research out in the environment. It's some nasty stuff. You don't want to use it in a place that it can be detrimental. So we are able to use a lot of our facilities. One of the most frequently used and my personal favorite is our geophysical research facility, which is basically a large concrete basin that we can create an artificial ice sheet for experimentation. We can grow ice at several feet thick. We can cut out sections. We can take out ice. We can inject oil underneath it or even freeze it into the ice. If it has added benefits of being outside, we can fly drones over it to look at the ice from above. We can fly ROVs underneath the water and look at the ice from below. There are just so many different applications.
Talk more about that facility specifically and some of, what is it, 60 feet by 20 feet, the depth,
yeah.
And like how much ice. I've seen all these reports. I just don't have it all memorized, but you can do like really thick ice and
yeah.
Tell us a little bit about all that it can do.
So it's 60 by 25 feet by 7 feet deep. And I mean, we can grow as much ice as we want to. My rule of thumb is usually 24 inches because we have 28-inch bar chainsaws. So
okay.
You still kind of want to be able to get underneath it, but we've done projects half a meter of ice. So there's really no limitation. It's more the needs of the project and the research.
Sure. And talk about some of the other facilities that you use for some of these projects.
I mean, CREL itself has, I don't even know how many cold rooms. Yeah. There's varying sizes from a small little walk-in closet to these big, huge hangars. We can put a whole wave tank into one of these cold spaces. It's just astronomical, the things that we can do and the options that we have. There's materials testing, there's CT scanners to look at ice. There's everything under the sun that anybody would ever want to play with.
Sure. And so kind of building on the facilities in a lot of ways, I understand that when some other organizations maybe are developing a different technology themselves, they will often come to you guys as a place that they can test that technology. Is that right?
Yeah, we like to say we're like the next stop before you go deploy something. So if it can make it here, you have a pretty high chance of making it out in the Arctic. It's bigger than any kind of like small bench scale kind of testing. It's a lot more analogous to the environment. So it's harsh, it's difficult. It really puts these technologies through their paces so that by the time you get all the funding and the effort and the manpower to get on a Coast Guard cutter up in the Arctic, you know that this is going to succeed.
Sure.
I'm interested in how you became involved in this research. Can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Absolutely. It's kind of a roundabout story, right? So My background is in ocean engineering, and I originally was joined Krell because of our energy and systems group. So I was going to be helping with marine renewables and other cold weather energy challenges. But not long after I started, there was a need to help with one of the oil team's projects having to do with some oil skimmers and ice. And they asked me to be involved due to my knowledge in wave mechanics and just marine environments in general. And so I helped out with that to start, and I just kind of was hooked after that. So I thought this topic area is just so interesting, and it really forces you to be creative in your solutions because it's so challenging. And I just wanted to keep learning about it. So I got more and more involved until here we are.
And you have a nickname, Chainsaw Kate. We have to hear that story.
I do. Yeah, that is a funny one. Not many people know it, but the best way to cut ice is to actually use a chainsaw. So you can use handsaws like you see in Nordic theme movies and things, but chainsaws are way faster and more efficient and also just a lot more fun. It's my favorite part of my job. Anytime I get to cut ice with a saw, it's just a great day. But that particular story, there's a photo of me cutting ice for a project that we did where we had to take out some sections of ice to get a sensor underneath the ice sheet. And the picture's got the full rooster tail of water behind me bending over with the saw and the ice and everything. And so Dr. Pittman saw the photo when he was up here one time visiting at Krell and coined the nickname for me. So every time I do a tour around here, someone always seems to kind of connect the dots and figures out that that's who I am. So I can't really complain, though, because that's a pretty great nickname, and not many people get one so cool.
Yeah. Kate, tell us about the rest of the team, kind of what unique backgrounds, experiences, expertise they bring to this.
We are a super tight-knit group. Everyone here has their specialty, and it makes for a super well-rounded and effective team. Obviously, as I mentioned earlier, I'm the engineering background for marine environments, that kind of thing. We've got an environmental engineer who specializes in behavior of oil. We've got a chemist who looks at the chemical properties. Of course, our engineering technicians that have decades of experience and are the ones that literally make the magic happen. So we've got all of our different perspectives that allow us to look at a problem from so many different angles. Somebody's going to ask a question that makes all of us think differently and things like that. And it allows us to kind of work together to put the best answer forward. And we as a team work in so many different Krell facilities that we're all really well versed in all of these different applications. Cold rooms, the GRF, our wave tank, so many different places. Plus, we have so much fun that there's no group that I'd rather work with.
Sure. It sounds like fun. And like you said, multidisciplinary, which I guess, you know, really adds a lot to it. Lets you tackle it from a lot of different areas, lean on each other and so forth.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you highlight some of the specific projects you've done? I know there are a variety of response strategies. So tell us a little bit about those and how you're supporting projects in some of the different areas.
Yeah, there are three big stages to a response effort for an oil spill. You've got detection, characterization, and recovery. That means you have to find the oil in the environment, figure out its properties, what the oil is, how much of it there is, and determine the method for removing it from the environment. We help out with all of these different stages. For an example, we worked with the U.S. Coast Guard Research and Development Center and NOAA to evaluate a UAS-based sensor to characterize oil in ice. So we set up a series of different oil targets within the ice, and the Coast Guard and NOAA flew their drone over the surface to see if they could detect different types of oil and different thicknesses when surrounded by ice, or if there was broken ice mixed in with the oil, all these different conditions. Another detection project that we worked on was with the Bureau of Safety Environmental Enforcement and the Applied Physics Laboratory at the University of Washington. They were looking at the oil from below. So they had a series of sensors mounted on an ROV looking upwards at the underside of the ice that had oil trapped within it. So we grew an ice sheet and injected oil into these cavities that we had created into the ice to sort of trap them in these little pockets. And then the sensor flew underneath those targets to see what sensors worked best at identifying both the presence and the thickness of oil, because they had some acoustic sensors, they had some UAV sensors, light, all these different things, trying to kind of throw everything at the wall and see what stuck. And that was really fascinating because you couldn't see the oil from above. So in a real world scenario, you'd never know it was there just by looking.
Real quick, ROV, you said that's remote operated vehicle. Is that correct?
Yes. Another project that we worked on that was focusing on the recovery side of things was what's called the Active Ice Management System. It was a shield, essentially, for an oil skimmer that allowed for the oil to pass through large chunks of ice and get to the skimmer to prevent those ice dams, kind of like we talked about. I affectionately call it the salad spinner of death because it's a large, round thing that has all these augers on the outside that spin and try and push the ice away from the skimmer so that the oil can still seep through. And that you're still able to keep pumping out oil from the environment. That was with the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement as well. Krell actually designed that system and patented it. So that one was a really cool one to be involved in.
Kate, I know another approach is in situ burns. And I know that you all do some work on that topic in part because I think some of the coolest pictures that come out of Krell are the pictures you at the facility of the oil on fire, and you've got this giant fireball, but it's all in the name of research. It's got to be fun to do too. Tell us a little bit about in situ burns and some of the research you all are doing.
Yeah, those are definitely some of the most exciting projects for sure.
Yeah.
In situ burns are a super valuable recovery method as opposed to mechanical recovery where you have to pump it out of the environment and then you're left with the oil to then dispose of. In situ burning gets the oil out of the environment very, very quickly. And there's different technologies and methodologies for how those are done, both with containment booms and different ignition systems and all these other kinds of things. Like we talked about with emulsification, all of these things factor into how well something burns. So there's a lot of research that goes into how can we improve burn efficiency? Because it's obviously, you're removing the oil from one environment and adding it to another environment. It makes it easier for cleaning, but there's still some stuff to be investigated in that. So how can we burn it efficiently and cleanly? And what technologies can we rely on to do that? So there's different things you can add into the oil for making the oil burn hotter longer. Because that's what kind of happens is you don't want it to be too thick where it sort of snuffs itself out, but you also don't want it to be too thin that you can't actually light it. So there's kind of this middle ground of optimum thickness for an oil slick and with which you can burn it. So looking at ways to collect it in these novel ways between boats and maybe herd it into these little corrals that make it easier to burn. These are all techniques that we've investigated, which are all impacted by ice and cold weather and all these other things, because like we talked about, those physical and chemical properties of oil change with changes in temperature. So maybe what works in the Gulf of Mexico for response to things like the Deepwater Horizon might not work if there's something in Alaska. So trying to tweak all of these technologies and methodologies so that they can be used in that kind of application.
Yeah. So as you said, it's a variety of topics on a variety of different areas. And, you know, as we kind of mentioned at the top, I know you do a lot of work creating environment and allowing others to test prototypes, kind of the expertise to create that environment and that it resembles, you know, the real world. But have you also done evaluations into projects or technologies that were developed by ERDC at Krell?
Yeah. So there's one we're doing right now. There's a project to use a high frequency electromagnetic interference sensor to detect the presence of oil. So this sensor was originally developed by Krell to detect unexploded ordnances in soils. And the discussion came up as to potential other applications for this sensor type. And one of those was detecting oil because it's based off of conductivity of different materials and things. And one of our electronics engineers brought up that oil should show up sort of like a void for this sensor. It looks like a metal detector. And what you would do is you pass it over some surface that maybe you can't, maybe it's a sheet of ice that has oil underneath it that you can't see. So you pass it over kind of looking for these pockets, trying to find oil that you can't see. basically your eyes in a different way. The U.S. Coast Guard is really interested for that technology and has funded us to adapt that sensor from the unexploded ordnance application to oil detection. So we're preparing that and getting ready to test that this coming winter.
Sure. You talked a little bit about it at the beginning, but oil trapped under the ice. You know, you said that when the ice freezes, when seawater freezes, it kind of creates those little, what you call them, brine channels.
Yep.
Because of the way the salt goes down, and that allows oil to come up through the ice. And so I guess my question is that common, you know, in an oil spill that you do see a good amount of oil that gets trapped under the ice that maybe people don't even realize is there?
It mostly depends on where you are. Mm-hmm. The Arctic has different ice conditions. You get, you know, single year ice that freezes and thaws every summer, or you get multi-year ice that maybe gets a little bit thinner, but it doesn't completely go away. So those are the potential chances you could have something. Maybe it was encapsulated into the ice and now the ice has melted, so it's back at the surface. Or maybe it was just underneath some multi-year ice and then the ice grew over the winter, so now it's trapped. It's those nuances that could happen, but you don't necessarily know.
And that's what really drives this effort, I guess. Like you said, there are so many nuances.
Absolutely.
We talked about the facilities at Krill, but how much does this effort also benefit from being housed at Krill and being able to lean into some of the multidisciplinary cold regions expertise that you have located right there on campus?
Just like our facilities, we're super lucky to have such a wealth of knowledge related to anything involving the polar regions of the world here. That's Krill's bread and butter. We've been known for that for decades. So we've got material scientists looking at microscopic structure of ice. You know, there's modelers for sea ice, climate scientists, chemists, biologists that are all could look at the effects of oil in the environment, and so many other people. There are so many experts here that any question that comes up that our team can't specifically answer might be about ice or the Arctic environment, whatnot. Someone here is going to have an idea. 60 plus years of information and experience, there's no better place to try and answer these questions.
And I guess it's convenient too, right? Because they're right down the hallway or right in the building, and finding those answers is a lot easier.
Exactly. You just go knock on people's door and say, hey, have you seen this?
Sure. Obviously, we talked about a lot about oil on ice, and that's a good amount of the work you guys do. But I know you talked previously that some of these same facilities and capabilities that you're kind of using to study oil spill response and icy conditions can also be applied to some other military and civil works research projects. Can you talk about some of that and some of the other applications that you all are working on?
Yeah, for sure. With the effects of climate change and the focus of the DoD in the Arctic, there are some new challenges that are being presented for our nation. Opening of shipping lanes, more vessel traffic in the area. We need to be aware of what's coming and going. Some of those things that have come up, we've worked with the Naval Research Lab that's looking at how wave propagation is impacted by different ice conditions from a navigational perspective. They've used particle image velocimetry, or PIV, basically some really cool green lasers that look at how waves are dampened with no ice, a solid sheet of ice, and then these big chunks of ice. We've also worked with another group from NRL to look at microwave radar and how their signals look like and how they change in an ice environment, trying to determine what the difference in signal is between ice and snow and water and an object. One of the most impactful projects that I've gotten to work on was one with the Coast Guard Research and Development Center in response to the capsizing of the fishing vessel, the Scandies Rose. That was up in Alaska, and so much ice had built up on the exposed crab pods during a voyage that it changed the weight of the vessel so much, and it caused it to capsize, unfortunately, costing the crew to lose their lives. So the Coast Guard was trying to develop a model for ice accretion on these crab pods to try and help inform other crews with, hey, if your crab pods look like this, you could potentially have X amount of weight gain.
Mm-hmm.
So working with them, we developed a way to spray seawater at these crab pods in one of our facilities and collected data on weight gain of ice over time. And remarkably, we found after even only 2 to 4 hours, we got approximately 2,000 pounds of ice developed.
Wow.
Just on three of those crab pots. And there's hundreds of those on these ships. So this kind of rapid ice growth can drastically affect the center of buoyancy of a vessel, and that can have disastrous results. So helping with that project was just really remarkable.
Wow. Yeah, that's incredible. You said 2,000 pounds, and that was just on three of the traps?
For only a couple of hours, which is crazy.
Yeah.
I know that there are probably some things that would surprise people regarding ice-related oil spill response. There's an old expression, oil and water don't mix, but that's not entirely true. So how does the interplay between oil and water impact cold weather oil spill response?
That's the crazy part, right? Like chemically, and oil and water don't mix. But everyone that's made a vinaigrette salad dressing knows that they emulsify. So that means oil can be incorporated into water to the point where you can't physically separate them easily. And oil can emulsify in the environment due to waves, rain, and even ice. So when an oil is spilled in an area with pieces of ice and wave action, that turbulence created between the pieces of ice by the waves almost acts like a blender, mixing up all the oil and the water. This makes it, in an already challenging environment, this makes recovery even more challenging. Because not only do you have to recover the volume of the oil, now it's mixed with a significant amount of water. Sometimes these emulsions can be 30% oil and 70% water. So a spill of 100,000 gallons just becomes exponentially larger.
Wow. How do you even get at a problem like that? I mean, is that something y'all have done a lot of research into?
Yeah, it's sort of a piece to a lot of these puzzles, right? Like some of the ISB or in-situ burning recovery methods looking at emulsions have issues because a substance that is composed of a lot of water doesn't burn very well. So normally an easy way or an effective way to remove oil from the environment quickly is to burn it so that it doesn't sink or one of those other things like we talked about. When it's emulsified, it doesn't burn very well. So maybe that's not the solution for that. But if you have to recover it mechanically by pumping it out, you have to have a vessel that can contain so much more volume than it would be if it was just oil because of that added water.
Is it harder to locate too when it's emulsified? Is it harder to find and even know it's there?
Potentially. It has a different signal with different sensors because of the difference in conductivity and light and all these other things. Whatever the sensor is looking at changes. It has a different response from fresh crude oil.
Speaking of harder to find, is it harder when you're using drones and unmanned aerial systems and so forth to find the oil? Does it blend in with the ice more than it would in a different environment? Is that like a specific challenge you're having to work on too?
I think less so that it blends in with the ice, it's that it can be obstructed by the ice.
Okay.
So instead of a big wide slick that you can see from miles away, it's kind of tucked in between all these pockets of broken ice, or maybe it's underneath the ice. So it's not a big volume that you can tell the difference between the surrounding environment. It might be multiple little pockets of oil because it's gotten separated. So that changes how we see it, because if you're looking from a wide perspective, maybe it's not able to find all those smaller pieces. Or if you're looking so closely, maybe you can't even see it because the ice is just in the way.
Sure. I guess, too, again, when you talk about, you know, icy conditions, I believe that two environments maybe that you're most focused on are the Arctic and the Great Lakes. Can you talk about each environment and some of the unique challenges that each presents?
Yeah, the Arctic has always been a focus given oil production and just a harsh environment in general. But the Great Lakes can be just as challenging. Both have a potential for oil spills and ice, and the conditions of each lead to different variables. Like we talked about, freshwater ice is different than sea ice. Their structures can change. They interact with the oils differently. And not only that, different oil types can be found in the Great Lakes than in the Arctic. Specifically, one of the big nasty ones that they always talk about is diluted bitumen, or dilbit. This is a really heavy crude oil that has to be diluted with other oils, even to be transported. It's just this really thick, it's almost like asphalt tar. And the difficult part of that is that if it is spilled, all those lighter oils that it's diluted with weather or evaporate much faster than the heavy oil, and you leave a tar substance behind. And it can get so thick that it'll actually sink. And this is a big concern for the Coast Guard and the Great Lakes, because its own super sensitive environment and ecosystem that the effects of this tar can be so nasty. We've worked with the Coast Guard on a project looking at how fast this particular oil type weathers from like a response time perspective. And we found that it takes 8 to 9 days for the oil to weather and sink before it's just gone. So being able to respond that quickly or to know that you have that many days before it's just unreachable is a very important piece of information.
Yeah, it gets back to the response time that we talked about earlier and why there's such urgency.
Exactly.
What does the future hold? What is on the cutting edge for this effort?
There's so many unknowns that are still involved in this research and just a general lack of data. Every project that we do sheds light on possible solutions. With the significant advancements in technology over the past several years, our ability to respond more effectively just continues to grow. Like we talked about, those unmanned aerial systems, remotely operated vehicles, you have autonomous systems now, faster data transfer and analysis, modeling even, everything just adds to the arsenal of technologies and methods that are available for oil spill responders to locate, quantify, and recover oil from icy environments.
Kate, thanks for joining us today. I think this is such an interesting topic area, probably an area that, again, we talked about how niche it is, but I think, you know, one of those areas that people don't think about that much. And I guess, too, it's one of the areas that you never want to see a disaster happen. I mean, maybe you hope that all the work you do never even gets used, but should one happen, we want to be as prepared as we can to respond as best we can. And I think it's, you know, awesome what you guys are doing. And thanks for taking some time to tell us more about it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. It's easy to forget how novel all of it is when you're entrenched in it, but it's just such interesting stuff to talk about that hopefully somebody learns something new.
Yeah, absolutely.
As the nation witnessed during the Exxon Valdez and Deepwater Horizon incidents, the environmental and economic toll from large-scale oil spills can linger for decades. That's why research into better techniques and technologies for rapidly responding to these disasters is critical. Through the world-class expertise and facilities at its Cold Regions Research and Engineering Laboratory, Arctic has developed a unique capability to enable in-depth research into mitigating oil spills on ice. This includes methods to find, characterize, and recover petroleum under a variety of conditions. As Arctic collaborates with partners to find these innovative solutions, first responders will be better equipped to have the greatest impact should a disaster occur.
The Power of Arctic podcast is a production of the U.S. Army Engineer Research and Development Center. Follow Arctic on LinkedIn, Facebook, and X, formerly known as Twitter, for the latest information. You can listen to the Power of Arctic podcast on all major podcast players. Visit powerofarcticpodcast.org for more resources. You can also contact us at powerofarcticpodcast@usace.army.mil. That's all for today. We'll see you next time.